okay. Well, good afternoon. So welcome to the session titled Emerging Issues for HIV-STI Prevention. I'm Jonathan Merman, the director of the Division of HIV-AIDS Prevention at CDC, and it's my task and honor to moderate the session. We're fortunate to have three esteemed speakers, Dr. Willie McFarland from the San Francisco Department of Health, Dr. Sharon Hillier from the University of Pittsburgh, and Dr. Lori Markowitz from CDC. They will discuss some of the most exciting issues in HIV and STI prevention today: serosorting, pre-exposure prophylaxis, and the use of human papillomavirus vaccine. I'm pleased that there's a session that includes two talks on HIV, the forgotten STI, and the potential implications of two HIV-focused interventions on other sexually transmitted infections. We're increasingly appreciating the syndemics of HIV and multiple STIs, and public health programs and interventions focused on HIV or specific sexually transmitted infections alone run the risk of having unforeseen outcomes unless we think in advance about implications for all of our infections. So given that, I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Willie McFarland, who will speak about serosorting implications for HIV and STD transmission. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about Dr. McFarland. He's an associate professor of epidemiology and biostatistics at the University of California in San Francisco. He's affiliated with the Prevention and Public Health Group in the Global Health Sciences Department. He's jointly appointed to the Center for AIDS Prevention Studies, or CAPS, and is also director of the HIV Epidemiology Section at the San Francisco Department of Public Health. He's conducted research on the epidemiology and prevention of HIV in California, the U.S., and internationally. His primary emphasis is on surveillance in most at-risk populations and the use of data for public health decision-making. In areas of training and capacity building, Dr. McFarland is the co-director of the NIH-sponsored traineeship in AIDS prevention studies, co-director for development at CAPS, and the coordinator of training for scholars from Africa and the Middle East. Educated at Stanford and Tulane, Dr. McFarland is board certified in general preventive medicine and public health, and he has a PhD in epidemiology from the University of California. So please join me in welcoming Dr. McFarland, who although he was laid off, as everyone else was, in the San Francisco Department of Health, he's hopefully, if you have any job offers, please approach him afterwards. You have about a day or two before he's rehired. So welcome, Dr. McFarland.
Good afternoon. So I took my charge for this section to try to address two questions. One, is serosorting increasing STI transmission? And two, does serosorting work as HIV prevention? But there's actually a question I think I need to address before we get to those two questions, and that's, what in the world do we mean by serosorting? I think this has become one of these words that have a lot of nuances, and each person is using it in a slightly different way. This particularly came to our attention when we started sharing some information with our Dutch colleagues. You know, we had thought, when we were speaking of serosorting, we meant this, that you have unprotected sex. If you're positive, you're having unprotected anal sex with another positive. If you're negative, you're having unprotected sex with another negative. If you were discordant, or if there was any doubt, then you would use a condom. So maybe I would qualify the San Francisco version of this as condom serosorting. Or perhaps you would engage in other sexual activities, like oral sex, which, you know, I think San Francisco is about as pro-oral sex as a city government can possibly be. It's on our website as an HIV prevention strategy, so, you know, we're very much in favor of it. And we also make distinctions of how certain you can be with positive-positive serosorting and negative-negative. Well, when we started talking with the Dutch to see if they were seeing these same phenomena, they're like, no, that's not serosorting at all. Serosorting in the Dutch sense was to have positive-positive partners, and you could engage in no other form of sex whatsoever. So that was sort of a pure serosorting. So we were like, well, what the heck? You're going to take oral sex away from us? This doesn't make sense. That also doesn't fly very well in San Francisco. This is where you start getting these accusations of putting another division within the community based on HIV serostatus. And words in the press started being bantered around, such as seroapartheid, serosegregation. And over time, you know, I've noticed that different countries kind of have slightly different versions of what serosorting can mean and which sexual practices they're actually talking about. But I think you have to give it to the Australians, though, for really thinking this through very carefully and coming up with the most colorful names. Even back in the 1990s, I think they were talking about negotiated safety, being unprotected sex between negatives and committed relationships. They launched campaigns. One was called Talk, Test, Test, Trust. They came up with the word strategic positioning, which is baffling as to how that relates to sex and not warfare. We tend to call that one seropositioning in San Francisco. And the latest one they're saying, and I think they make a good point, that a lot of these forms, unless there's really good disclosure and accurate information, they all might just be sero-guessing. Now, we also have our colorful expressions in San Francisco as well. Anyone want to guess what sushi sorting would be? Now, this is something that my friend Ron Saul shared with us. He said even back in the early 1980s, at the beginning of the epidemic, they would, I don't know if it's urban legend or if he actually did this, but you would take a date to a Japanese restaurant, and if they avoided the raw fish, then you might suspect they're immunocompromised, so therefore sushi sorting. Now, I know that I'm being kind of glib and flippant about this, but the point actually is valid, that some form of deducing people's serostats or talking about their infection status probably has existed since the beginning of the epidemic. And although I was invited to speak in a section called Emerging Topics, this is actually nothing new. Its implications might be shifting over time, but some form of serosorting or sushi sorting has existed over time. Of course, the French have to have a different word for everything. But I will give them the last word on this. They've created sort of a universal term called seroadaptation, which is much more of an umbrella term that might cover all these different sexual practices. So in other words, the basis would be that your decisions about what you do sexually would depend on what you know about your own serostatus and what you know about your partner's serostatus. And I think it makes quite a, when you're trying to measure how common these seroadaptive strategies are, you really have to make distinctions on what you're talking about. So here in a recent survey we conducted in San Francisco, these were what HIV-negative MSM reported consistently doing across all their partnerships, all sexual acts for the last 6 months. 14% reported no sex during that period, 13% only had oral sex, no anal sex, and consistent condom use, 100% of the time was reported by 27%. Now, as an individual prevention strategy, that would come out to be the most common. But if you aggregate these various seroadaptive strategies, in aggregate, they come out to be more common than consistent condom use. So the Dutch or pure serosorting, 23%, oral sex serosorting, condom serosorting, seropositioning, come to total up to 40%. That leaves behind 7% of what you would then identify as the highest risk behavior, and that would be unprotected, receptive anal intercourse with a man who's known to be HIV positive or of unknown serostatus. Now, running the same criteria for the HIV positive respondents, similar proportion overall, 38%, but you can see that condom use is much lower than it was for HIV negative. And sex of highest risk, in this case, unprotected, insertive anal intercourse with someone known to be HIV negative or unknown serostatus, by 19% of the population. Now, it also matters whether you're considering what someone consistently does with all their partnerships or what they do within different types of partnerships or what they do with different types of sexual acts. So here are those data again combining positives and negatives. Now, it looks like seroadaptation would be the most common preventive strategy in the population. Now, a lot of that, though, might be driven by having one main partner of the same HIV serostatus. When you consider that men are doing different things with different types of partnerships, the pattern shifts a little bit. Now, at this point, consistent condom use with each partnership becomes more common than seroadaptive strategies. Now, if you consider the sexual acts that are being done, the pattern shifts a little bit more. Now, here we have predominantly most acts are oral sex. So see, I told you that San Francisco, we love oral sex. Here are the data to back that up. Okay, so enough of the definitions and background. You can see that there's a lot of nuances in what we're talking about and how you measure serosorting. So let me get to that first question posed. Is serosorting increasing sexually transmitted infections? There's my answer, yes. What was the second question? Now, I do this glibly also because, you know, don't you hate it when, like, a presenter puts a question out at the beginning of a presentation and they never quite really answer it very clearly? So I'm giving you my clearest, most crystal clear answer to that first question as yes. Now, I'm being a little bit provocative in this. It's nuanced as well. But the reason I'm saying it this way is that when I think back historically to the events that got us thinking about Sarah sorting, this question or this hypothesis was actually reversed. We weren't thinking at the time, well, because we're seeing a lot of serosorting, are we going to see increases in sexually transmitted infections? It was actually the other way around. We were seeing increases in sexually transmitted infections without seeing any evidence of an increase in HIV transmission. So these data seem to suggest that you could have increasing amounts of unprotected sex overall, but if that sex were more likely to be concordant, you could see sexually transmitted infections increase without HIV increasing. Now, added to this was this observation that of these syphilis cases, which we saw start in the late 1990s, I think San Francisco probably has the dubious honor being maybe a year ahead of the international trend in this. We saw that syphilis was exponentially increasing, but HIV actually leveling off or even going down. 65% of these new syphilis cases were MSM who said they already knew that they were HIV positive. I don't know if we've quantified it, but the typical story when you talked about partner notification for HIV was that, no, my partners know that they're already HIV positive. So if you triangulate these findings together, this really spoke to a very, a network of HIV positive men having unprotected sex with other HIV positive men. And then we were also seeing data from the Stop AIDS Project that this might actually be behaviorally documented as well. Now, from the late 1990s to the early noughties, I guess I said, it sounds weird, noughties, early noughties, there was a rise and then a plateau in overall levels of unprotected anal intercourse. But if you separate out what HIV, people who knew they were HIV positive, whether they're having discordant sex with HIV negatives or unknown, that actually peaked around 2001 and started to go down. Even more dramatically, the data on HIV negatives showed a decrease after 2001 in potentially serodiscordant sex. So this gap between the overall level of unprotected sex and what is discordant unprotected sex is the level of serosorting that was occurring. So again, the inference in our minds was the other way around, that we were seeing this increase in sexually transmitted diseases during this period gave credence to and support to the hypothesis of serosorting. We were also getting some evidence that it was really much more about a less concern over HIV transmission than it was about as other STIs. So you can see when we asked men who had unprotected sex with another positive man, what was the reason behind this? They said, well, because I'm not really worried about HIV transmission. Far less mention about being worried about STI transmission. And, you know, typically in the qualitative interviews, the typical thing was, well, I already have the mother of all STDs, and it's not curable, so why should I be worried about these curable bacterial infections? Well, of course, that's all well and good when it is a curable infection. What about herpes or HPV? Or what's really starting to send shivers up our spine is what might be happening with hepatitis C transmission. In the last few years, there's been increasing notice of rises in hepatitis C transmission among HIV-positive MSM, particularly those on ART, that are not injection drug users. And particularly in Western Europe and Australia, the prevalence seems to be rising up to 20% of the population. Now, this could be an indication of unmasking of sexual transmission of hepatitis C. We tend to think that this is less likely to happen, but maybe in a background of being immunocompromised, in a background of high levels of unprotected sex, other STIs like LGV making a reappearance, then we're worried that maybe we're going to see an increase in sexually transmitted hepatitis C. Now, I'll be honest with you, we haven't yet seen evidence of this in San Francisco, but we've been recently going back to our stored serological specimens in our freezers and pulling them out and testing them. And actually, it's now looking worrisome that we might be seeing the same thing as Western Europe and Australia. Just got a text from the lab just yesterday that it preliminarily screening looks much higher than we expected. Now, I understand there is still some doubts about the level of sexual transmission of hepatitis C, but this is now a much more serious, if it is sexually transmitted, it's much more serious, has implications for the care of HIV as well. Okay, so what about the second question? Does serosorting work as HIV prevention? So, again, I'll give you my crystal clear answer on this. Okay, so this is a maybe. It's not a maybe because I haven't given it enough thought. It's a maybe because I have genuine, profound ambivalence on this. And I go back and forth in my mind as to what is the net effect of serosorting on the epidemic. The more data we see, the more arguments that come out, the more publications from around the world, there's some very strong arguments in its favor and some very strong arguments against serosorting's effect on the epidemic. So let me start with the case in favor. Now, the case in favor, I think, has what we would scientifically refer to as face validity. That, of course it should work, right? If two people are HIV uninfected, there should be no HIV transmission. And to some extent, you know, people that are already infected, it's not a case of new HIV infection, and there is some level of reinfection that probably happens. There's other people would contend that there are conditions now that facilitate serosorting. Overall, there's been a big push for HIV testing and high-frequency testing in MSM populations. The level of unknown infection now is lower than it's ever been. I think Seattle probably does even better than we do in this regard. Others point to the internet being a semi-anonymous tool that can increase serostatus disclosure, or you can find by particularly searching on partners for different serostatus. And we just showed you the data that we do know that, at least on the face of it, it seems to be done often enough that it should have an impact on the epidemic. I mean, if you in aggregate, once again, it was far more common than consistent condom use as a prevention strategy. So what's the case against? Now, I'll tell you, we were very enthusiastically supporting serosorting as a prevention strategy as a health department. We put out a press release promoting it. Our website promoted it. But right away, we got hate mail on this. And it was starting to reveal some things that, starting to reveal things that we should have thought twice about. It's interesting, the hate mail came in two forms. One was the form that this is, once again, a division being fostered in the community, seroapartheid, serosegregation. You know, and the implication there is that it's going to work, that the fear is that it's actually dividing people. The other form of hate mail was more along the lines that this was very irresponsible for us to promote, that nobody is doing serosorting correctly enough, that we're being misled as to what people are telling us, and it might have a harmful effect on the epidemic. In other words, the exact opposite, that it's really not going to foster the division between people of different serostatus. This gets along the lines of what the Australians seem to be warning us, that, if it's anything short of real accurate disclosure of serostatus, particularly for negatives, it's just seroguessing. And then more and more data seem to be coming out that it's not really happening, that it doesn't really work, and it could actually be causing harm. The first is, suppose that you're mistaken about your own HIV serostatus. Suppose you're a serosorter, but you're actually HIV infected. Well, then that's the exact opposite of serosorting. You're purposely seeking out the very partners for unprotected sex who you're most likely to infect. Now, add into this paradigm of acute infection, that you're most contagious when you're early in infection, when your viral load is high, and actually even before you might be HIV antibody positive. And then you set up what is becoming a leading paradigm to explain why there's such high levels of HIV transmission in heterosexual populations in Africa. The paradigm goes something like this. You have overlapping partnerships. People have multiple partnerships that overlap in time, where they all presume they're HIV negative and having, therefore, unprotected sex. So this would be a scenario of promotion of HIV serosorting for negatives. Now, if acute infection enters anywhere within that network, then it can burn very fast through it. And there are some proponents that would say, do you remember that? I made that in your living room. Yeah. Got to use it finally. Can I do it again? There we go. That this might be an explanation for why we have a high prevalence of HIV in this population, why we have high prevalence of HIV in heterosexual populations in Africa. So this is very worrisome. Fostering the notion that negative-negative serosorting is okay as long as you're all negative could could then result in this phenomenon. And you could be anywhere in this chain. You'd be pretty certain about your partner's serostatus, but if it enters that chain at any one point, it can move very fast through it. There was hints that something like this may have been seen in North Carolina with an outbreak along chains of acute infection. And I've also seen several different models that predict that the outcome of negative-negative serosorting promotion would actually increase HIV transmission over simply saying that people would pick their partners at random. I think there's one interesting simple model by Pinkerton that said this, that in a background scenario that looked pretty much what he was describing, San Francisco, randomly selecting partners and having a certain level of condom use would actually be better off than trying to select negative partners to have unprotected sex. So in here again, if we look at the case of what we're seeing in San Francisco, 40% of the HIV negative MSM were engaging in some form of seroadaptation. What was interesting is a slightly higher proportion, 48% of the people that thought they were HIV negative and turned out to be HIV positive were engaging in what looked like seroadaptation. So once again, that's a worrisome mistake to make, because that's the opposite of serosorting if you're seeking out the partners that you might most likely to infect. And we do get the sense that, you know, this disclosure that people say they're doing might not be as certain as we'd like it to believe. So if there's even doubts about your own serostatus, think for a moment how much doubt you would have about your partner's serostatus. So we're asking them, how did you know the serostatus? Now, for the most part, you can see for those that truly were negative, their answer is kind of what you'd want to hear, that I asked or that they told me spontaneously. But a substantial number are still saying they're deducing it from things they said, the appearances, things that their friends are telling them, or some other mechanism of doing this. And those that were wrong about their own serostatus, even more reliance on those factors. In fact, that may be related to why they were now infected in the first place. And studies that are coming out, I won't repeat them all, but lots of studies are coming out that are finding that serosorting actually may be a risk factor for acquiring HIV infection. Cohort studies are starting to see that the rate of seroconversion among serosorters is higher than those that are not. It's very often done incorrectly. The true serostatus is not really known. And it's not particularly increased by the internet, I think maybe for positives to some degree, but it doesn't seem to be so for negatives. And overall, in the net assessment is that it offers only limited protection from HIV transmission. Okay, but so then where's my ambivalence again? Let me go back. And so before we throw the baby out with the bathwater, I have to think again of a few things. First of all, I think the literature does weigh in favor of positive-positive serosorting is actually working on that side of the equation. And there's even some randomized controlled trials that say pos-pos serosorting can be increased through direct interventions. In some cases, that was the primary outcome of the randomized trial. In others, it's been a byproduct of just reducing risk overall. If you think about it, the negative-negative serosorting is still implicit in some of the other ways that we try to prevent HIV infection. The push for testing and the push for disclosure is very much linked to choosing partners that are of the same serostatus and making judgments on what you're going to do with those partners. We in San Francisco have always sort of promoted this sense of a hierarchy of risk, whether you engage in oral sex, protected sex. This is implicit in a negative-negative serosorting strategy. And then if you think about it, if we buy into the notion of positive-positive serosorting, well, then that leaves behind the potential for more negative-negative serosorting. So I think we're not necessarily going to get away from including some form of negative-negative serosorting in our prevention efforts. And the fact that this has always existed is the most predominant prevention strategy. I think if we ignore it, we ignore it at our own peril as well. The effectiveness of negative serosorting, you have to also think through on this. It probably could be made more effective, but you also have to think that it depends on the scenario that you're finding it in. If you were entering a scenario where 100% condom use was high, it would seem to be foolhardy to then switch to serosorting. But on the other hand, you might find yourself in situations where condom use is very low, in which case it may be replacing a higher risk behavior. So again, I'm hoping you're sharing my ambivalence on this. This is what I'm communicating when I say it might be or it could be made to be HIV prevention. So let me wrap up with a few summary conclusions. First of all, bear in mind that serosorting is a reality of how MSM manage HIV risk. It always has been. Maybe it's increased in recent years, maybe it's stabilized in recent years. But again, this is a community-generated response to the epidemic, and these are the types of responses that you can't ignore if we're going to try to make it more effective. I do think, I'll stand by my answer, that I do think it has high potential to foster the sexual transmission of other sexually transmitted infections. As far as HIV acquisition, well, I'm not yet convinced it works for HIV negatives, not yet. And it will have a lot of challenges if we're going to try to make it work. For positives, I do think that the door is open, that this can be an effective prevention strategy for onward transmission of HIV. So I'll end there. Let me just actually thank Mary Cam and the other organizers for inviting me here. Thank you.
I'll stay up there. Thank you very much, Willie. We have a few minutes for questions if people would like to ask any or make comments. Please.
Yeah, well, again, for positives, if it's sort of this case detection and diagnosing people and treating them, and we have more confidence that positive serosorting can work, so it would help on that side of the equation, I believe. Handing out a lot of negative diagnoses with that is more problematic. I think, you know, at a bare minimum, you need to increase the level of testing and a high frequency of testing. So in that sense, it gets probably part of the first step to getting towards effective negative-negative serosorting. But after that, I think it becomes more and more challenging, you know, how to give people the skills to correctly disclose. There will always be uncertainty in what the partner is stating as their serostatus. How do they know that? When were they last tested? Did they have risk since that test? So I think those challenges are still there, but to the extent that it's diagnosing more positives and getting them into treatment, it could be opening the door for that. To the extent it increases the frequency of testing among negatives, it's a step on the right direction.
Thank you.
I'm wondering if positive serosorting, there are diseases that we're looking at ARV resistance I was in a few years, and one of the things that I'm feeling serosorting is besides status of the partner, are they on meds?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, for this, I would paraphrase what I heard Bob Grant say. I mean, the worry over superinfection and reinfection seems to have subsided somewhat. I think his take is that, yes, it can happen. Lots of people have been looking for it for many, many years. We can document it. It happens. Less common than we might have thought. Multi-resistant or resistant reinfection also happens. Yes, you know, it does. But I think if you get to the bottom of this cascade of evidence, at the end of the day, I don't think they've ever encountered where there weren't treatment options for this kind of reinfection, multi-resistant reinfection. So I think we're more sanguine than we might have been when they coined the phrase superinfection, which, you know, sounds like a monster sort of bug going out there. So and Bob Grant also says this, you know, if you don't leave people realistic options and avenues for gratifying sexual expression, you might have some pushback on the other side. So I think in the equation of that, worry over multi-drug resistance and reinfection and superinfection is less than it used to be.
So
it seems like Hep C is now the one that is more concerned with pause serosorting. We'll see what the evidence says.
Thank you. One more question, Willie, for me, which is just you've, I think, eloquently shown some lack of conclusion about some of the questions. But at this point, if you think we needed more information to make firm conclusions about serosorting, what studies would you design?
I think we're chipping away at it, but we need more information on how people disclose and the set of skills it takes to disclose. and how they process information about what their partners are telling them in terms of when they tested what they know and how certain they are. I mean, I think the Australians have already done, they've probably done the research that we might need to repeat or take the lead from. I mean, they had the whole talk, test, test, trust was an effort to really make certain that, you know, you weren't in the window period, that serostatus was mutually disclosed, that it's done within relationships. I mean, that's the line of research that I think we need to pursue in the US.
Thank you.